You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
Find us on the web, ang-newswire.blogspot.com.
You are listening to the Angry Indian Unintelligent Aboriginal Radio.
This is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio, and welcome back. So, you know, a lot of you know, all of you know, especially those of you who are regular listeners, know I am not particularly keen on capitalism. I never have been. And it's not because I have a problem with people making money. It's not because I have a problem with people having things. That's not the issue. And for people who, you know, want to continue to hit me with that, you're really going in the wrong direction. That's not the issue. You know, the issue is, how do you gain that? How did you get that money? You know, did you screw over your people in order to do that? Did you harm somebody else? You know, do you have a youth someplace, a minor who is chained to a machine that's working for you for 3 cents an hour? See, that's what I'm talking about. Because there's a certain level of karma that comes along with that. You know, and we have to understand it when we talk about empire. Now, I'm a proud Geechee. You know, and I've never apologized for that, and I never will. But we derive partially, at least many of us, from the Yoruba Empire. And we like to point to Shango, you know, who was the king of the Oyo Empire. But empire, when we think about empire, do we understand what that means? You know, when we talk about the Zulu Empire, especially Chaka Zulu, you know, empire. In order for you to be able to consolidate empire, you know, whether it's Genghis Khan, whether it's Chaka Zulu, whether it's Charlemagne, you have to use force against the common people. You have to force them to accept your rule, because obviously no one wants to be under anybody's thumb. I mean, we've all been young, and the first thing you think about, you know, once you get a breath of the world and you understand that the bubble is round, you know, you want to be on your own. You want to start making your own decisions. You want to have control over your own life. So why wouldn't entire communities, why wouldn't an entire people want to be free? So we're going to speak to someone that I've been conversing with online. You know, a lot of our guests, of course, come from the world of Twitter. And, you know, this particular brother, we were talking about, or at least I was getting in a conversation this particular evening about economics and about where the African diaspora fits into economics. Whether it's Mugabe, whether it's Brother Mandela, or whether it was happening in Egypt, because I'm talking about the entire continent. I'm talking about Brazil. I'm talking about North America. I'm talking about all of the Americas. You dig what I'm saying? You know, we are not limited to any one particular sphere. You know, I know a lot of you don't know about Patrice Lumumba University in Russia, and that's a shame. Because, you know, Alexander Pushkin was one of our greatest poets, and he happened to be in Russia. You know, we don't understand the entire breadth and width and weight of what we are as African people. And I've been talking to Brother Self-Made here online for a little while. And, you know, obviously, you know, we're not coming exactly from the same political position, but we both agree that the African, wherever he is in the world, wherever she is in the world, should be empowered to make their own decisions and be able to take care of self. So I want to welcome Brother Self-Made to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
All right. Thank you, sir. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, man. So, you know, it's not that we were disagreeing. You know, it's just that, you know, we're coming from two different tacks on it. And I hate to put it right like this, you know, but, you know, this is an international podcast. So, you know, people are listening from all over the world. And there's a particular paradigm that's understood in terms of, you know, the political spectrum, whether it's right or left. I actually think that you and I are pretty centrist. You know, but we're going to probably be split up by people who are listening to this, because this is where things have been limited. It's not their fault. It's just, this is where things have been limited. Now, right. You know, those of us, I mean, those people who have been listening to the show for quite a while, they already know my position in terms of economics. So why don't you give people a brief rundown of who you are and, you know, what it is that, you know, you're trying to get out here to the rest of the people in the African diaspora.
Oh, okay. Thanks, man. Thanks for the opportunity to be on your show. My name is Gervais Bunker, and my parents are originally from Cameroon. My mom was born in this town called Douala, and I grew up pretty much between here and there. Here I grew up in Tallahassee, Florida, and I've been to Douala. I've lived in 3 different continents. Mm-hmm. And I've had the opportunity to see the African diaspora from several different angles, you know. And one thing that was always common was that a lot of brothers that are actually outside the continent, they all trying to do something good for the continent as a whole. I'm actually a junior civil engineering student at Howard University. And yeah, that's about it. You know, I've been involved in different organizations in college and in high school. A lot of them had to deal with, you know, empowering our people. You know, getting young people to really rise up, because I think after the civil rights movement kind of died down, our generation, because I was born in the 80s, our generation and this new generation, I mean, there's such a distance from what used to be us, you know, when you look at how far we've come, and you look at what we're doing today, it's just like two completely different worlds.
Well, let me ask you this at this point. You know, how would you articulate the state of Black America under Obama, and not just from this term, but his entire, you know, period in office?
Yeah, it's... Well, the problem is, I think it's in complete disarray. But what the positive thing that came out of it is the fact that you can always... Now you see so many young people that are actively involved in politics. Ever since Obama came onto the scene, many young guys, young brothers and sisters out there, they joined, you know, little movements. You know, some of them went back to school like myself. You know, many of them also started to pay attention to things they really never paid attention to. I mean, for the most part, growing up, for the most part in the 90s and stuff like that, I mean, we didn't really, you know, care much about politics, you know? It wasn't something that we really wanted to be involved in. It was like growing up, you know, things that was their talk. So we didn't really want to get involved in. And our kids, our younger brothers and sisters, as they were coming up, you know, in late 90s and now in 2000, they kind of lost track of that, you know. And when you look at this generation and past generation, it's like two completely different worlds. It's like day and night. Now under Obama, we've seen a rise of a young generation that is now getting involved in the thing, you know. And it's a beautiful thing, you know. I along with about 300 students, during the 2012 campaign, we went across the country in different areas to canvass for the president and talk to people. You know, I was amazed. I mean, we went into Cleveland, Ohio, and I was flabbergasted because there was so many people that knew things. You know, I was knocking on doors and I was expecting, you know, I was expecting people to be like, yeah, you know, be like kind of angry or just disconnected, but a lot of them were very receptive. You know, they invited us in. We sat down at the table and we talked politics. I mean, and people were more involved. They asked about their, you know, what do you think about Sherrod Brown, who was the candidate for Senate in Ohio, in the Cleveland area. You know, and when we went down to Virginia Beach, when we went down to Norfolk, you know, people were actually interested. You know, I'm talking about young people. This is something, you know, that you wouldn't have seen. I think about 10, 15 years ago when, you know, when we had the Bush and Gores, and, you know, after the Clinton years. This is something that you really wouldn't see young people talk about. But now, there's more and more interest coming from young people as far as politics is concerned. The real problem that I have with the whole movement is that in a sense, we've had some black brothers and sisters who I wouldn't call them detractors, because they're discontent with what Obama represents and what he's doing, which is really something I thought was a disgrace to our community. And I've been on numerous discussion panels, especially on Twitter, going back and forth with so many of them. You know, they consistently ask the same question: what has he done for black people? What has Obama done for black people? And everybody else seems to be getting whatever it is that they ask from him. There's brother Michael X. Dyson, who's a brother I love dearly, because he's so insightful and just full of love and knowledge. You know, I every time I get a chance to sit down and talk with him, you know, it's just such a joyful experience, because he's just like a walking library, you know. But you know, he and so many others, like Dr. Connor or Dr. West or Tavis Smiley, you know, they seem to always try to throw some shade, you know, at what Obama's doing, and or he is not doing, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, but is it shade or is it criticism? See, I'm making the argument that it's criticism. You know, it's criticism.
Yeah, I mean, but after a while, I mean, I put them in different categories, because I would say. Brother Dyson, for example, he criticizes the president, because this is a man who's been on the president's side for years. All right, he was behind him when most people didn't even know about him back in '91. But at the same time, when you look at someone like Tavis Smiley, now he just sounds like he's just hating, like he's just throwing shade completely. I mean, there's a serious line between just criticizing and offering alternatives, offering your part to help.
But this is why I wanted to talk to you, because a lot of folks who have been disagreeing with me, you know, in the community, are like, oh, well, you know, you've never been supportive of Obama. And that's not really true. You know, see, the thing is, I support him as a black man doing what he wants to do. But the fact is, we're talking about somebody who boycotted the International Racism Conference not just once, but twice. This is someone who is not supportive of reparations, but he's supportive of, you know, payments to the Israeli government. A government which practices genocide against indigenous Palestinians, against indigenous Arab people who are native to that area. See, these are contradictions. This is somebody who won the Nobel Peace Prize, but yet has a kill list, but yet has, you know, drone attacks and so on, who has indefinite detention, and how many brothers are in the system? Now, we can look at this historically, and I mean, when I say historically, I mean factually, and look at the Clinton administration, Bill Clinton, you know, big dog, Bubba, who came up with the new crime bill. I know a lot of people don't remember that, because we have an attention span of a gnat here in the United States, that they forget about the new crime bill, which made racial profiling federal.
Right.
The idea of someone having dreadlocks or wearing their hair naturally as an afro is means to have you stopped and searched. You know, he did this. This is when people started going in the joint en masse. Now, I'm not saying that Nixon didn't have a part of this. I'm not saying that Ronald Reagan didn't have a part of this. There's a degree that Jimmy Carter had a part of this, but they never allowed the privatization that Bill Clinton did. You know, this is why I try to tell people, you know, don't get stuck on this whole Democrat thing. Because if you listen to the Republicans, they pretend that they give a damn about you. They don't care about your having abortions. They want you to have as many abortions as possible. They're trying to stop white females from having abortions because that's the majority of the ethnic group in this country that has abortions. You know, we're really twisted and what the hell is going on, because anybody, I mean, I hate to say this like this, but I'm going to tell you straight out how I see it. When, what was his name that had Vibe? Comedian, whatever, the Vibe show, before Sinbad took it over, whatever his name was. Brother that had that show, he had Bill Clinton on that show. Bill Clinton went up there and played sax, and you know, you couldn't say anything negative about Bill Clinton. And I forget which sister it was either Toni Morrison, one of them, that said, you know, he was the first black president of the United States. So no one ever questioned the fact that he was putting the majority of us in the system.
True.
You know, no one looked at that because they said, well, Democrats are supposed to be on your side. But see, but then you get the Republicans. And I'm not talking about the black Republicans now. I'm talking about the Republican Party itself, who will tell you all the time, well, it was the Democratic Party that, you know, founded the Klan. Well, this is historically true. But it's also historically true to who makes up the ranks of the Ku Klux Klan today. Not Democrats. You know, in 1964, when the Civil Rights Bill was signed, when they were even talking about the Civil Rights Bill, that's when you had the conversions between Democrat and Republican. So, you know, they've been pushing lies and telling the black man and woman in the Americas that if you jump on the bandwagon with us, that we'll make sure that you have everything, when they're really not telling you that they're limiting your voting rights, that they're limiting your housing choices, that, you know, the Democrats don't give a damn about you, but they're not actively working against you. See, the Republicans actually are. You know, and they're using capitalism as a means to do this. And the Democratic Party uses capitalism as a means to keep you down. Now, I've been very open here about my criticism of Jay-Z, especially after what he said recently about Harry Belafonte. My, you know, entire critique of what is supposed to be hip-hop and what have you is based on my critique of capitalism. Not the creative end, but how they allow themselves to be used by the system. I mean, I don't know any other ethnic group. Now, like I said, you know, I'm mixed. I don't know any other ethnic group that calls themselves by the epithet that is used against them. But we're on, you know, national television and now international media making arguments on why we should call ourselves niggas. I mean, capitalism to me has a lot to play in this. I mean, what is your position on
Absolutely. I mean, it's exactly what I continue to say. It's a system that was designed from the beginning to hold us down. Mm-hmm. And those of us who have thrived in it, they continue to use it, all right, and take advantage of its benefits. But at the same time, what do we do? What do we do to get out from out of its hand? Because right now, you know, when you talk about, you know, Jay-Z and what he said, that's exactly what the problem is. This guy, they've made money. They've made plenty of money with capitalism. So they're not ready to let that go. All right? So anytime you try to stop them in their tracks, it seems like you're just hating on them. But that's not necessarily true. Mm-hmm. Because we still have to hold ourselves to a certain standard, especially when we've made money and have made it in life. We have to use that power that we have to try and get other people, you know, out from poverty.
Well, see, this is where I agree with you, and I made slight mention to this on the last dispatch. You know, I belong to four different ethnic groups, be straight up. And, you know, the only one that seems to always be trying to hurt each other seems to be my African blood, you know.
And it's true. It's obvious. I mean, that is empirically true. It's right there. We see the evidence. Like I say, I've lived in Africa. I've lived in Cameroon. You have a system that is designed to keep the same idiot in place.
In place.
And you have a man that's 79 years old, and He's almost on his deathbed, but they keep reviving him and giving him position after position in the government. But they have a country that is mostly young. All right, they never turn to, okay, I think it's about time we start looking at these young guys and these young women and bring them into political life, you know? But it's mind-boggling to me when I think about it. When you think about the guys like the Thomas Sankara, the Patrice Lumumba, mm-hmm. and the Cheikh Anta Diop, and the brothers like Sekou Toure, these guys, they had a vision. They had a vision of getting their people out of the European hands. That's what they dreamed about. But what ended up happening is, you have all these other criminals who just went behind the scenes and made deals with the same people that are destroying their countries. And all they have to do is just keep them in power for as long as possible, and they'll be fine. You can get whatever you want to get out of this country as long as you keep me in power. Now, you flip the script. Here, we have the exact same system. We try to keep each other down every single day. All right? And it's something that I have, like, the greatest, difficulty at understanding. I can't. I just can't fathom it. I mean, at times I sit there and I try to reason my way out of it. I say, after a while, you hear something from black people. Mostly, our time will come. Everybody's had their time to rule the world. Eventually, our time will come. Guess what? Our time came before. I mean, the pharaohs in Egypt, they ruled the world for the most part back in the day. You know, but we don't seem to be really conscious of what we want to do. All right, and it's sad, and you think about, and this is to bring home the point that I was making about capitalism. We can make it work for us too. All right, we just can't. It's bad. I know it's bad, but we have to find a way to make it work for us, so we too can thrive in it. That's my whole point. I'm not saying that, well, we just sit down and just do nothing or just complain about it. But how about we try to do something? I mean, you have countries in Africa who owe more than they're worth to Europe.
Well, they're following the European paradigm. You know, they're following the European system. They kept all of the borders. They kept the religions. You know, they kept the political systems. They kept the military systems. You know, one of the things that Bolivia did when Evo Morales was elected president over there, they dismantled the military for the most part. They reassigned it along indigenous lines. Now, I mean, can they repel borders? Well, I would hope so for their own sake. But, you know, they're definitely not an imperialistic power. They're not trying to be. They're trying to take care of Bolivia. You know, what I'm saying is they went back to a mindset that fit the people who actually lived there. In the case of Africa, it's still trying to fit itself into France. It's still trying to fit itself into Portugal. It's still trying to fit itself into Britain. It's still trying to fit itself into Italy. You know, in terms of Liberia, it never really considered itself part of the rest of Africa. You know, historically speaking, politically speaking, it's always considered itself to be an outpost of the United States, and it's continued along in that pattern. So, we're both understanding where each other is coming from, you know, but the question goes, of course, you know how to get there. But one of my angles is we need to discuss COINTELPRO. We need to discuss the war, the psychological war against African people. We need to discuss the Tuskegee experiment. We need to discuss the probability that AIDS and HIV was, you know, centered in not just Africa, but other poor nations. We can look at the Rockefeller Report, and we can see evidence of this, at least it gives a probability, especially in terms of the history of human experimentation against Africans in this country. That, you know, we just don't fail just because of some genetic, you know, inherent fault, that we're failing because there's always something undermining us. And before you give me your answer on this, I would like to point out to the listeners that you, and I brought this example up before, that the South African police under apartheid was more than 95 to 98% indigenous black African personnel. So, you know, you have to ask yourself, you know, who was really controlling things when you have a ridiculously, you know, minority that's running things. And then you have to ask yourself, where does Obama fit into this? You have to ask yourself, you know, really, where does Mandela fit into this? Because the white mainstream didn't lose a thing when the ANC came to power. Now, the Boers certainly lost something, but we have to understand something. Under the British, the Boers were nothing. And you have to look at the British Empire war against the Boers in South Africa to understand this. That there was a class distinction amongst whites there, and that the Boers made up the bulk of the blue collar, of the police jobs. They were the buffer class. And now that apartheid is not in, and these people were really not considered part of the elite, they live in the townships next to black people now, next to the colored class, right? The Malaysian class, the Indian class. They live in the same townships now that they used to, you know, are totally oppressed, that their class oppressed. So, you know, brother, you know, are we understanding these dynamics when we're looking at our situation here in North America and throughout the diaspora?
I mean, I get the point that you bring. And again, in a discussion we had on Twitter regarding what Obama has done, I've said one thing. It's, what is her agenda? What's the black agenda? Mm. Because especially after the civil rights movement and the arrival of things like affirmative action, we kind of just died out. Like there was nothing else that we've been kind of blank. That's why this entire time there's been this period with nothing in between it that we actually fought for. I mean, it felt like, okay, we got a civil rights movement. We have the right to vote. We have, you know, we have affirmative action, and then we cool. And things just kind of fade out after a while. After a while, all you have is just like every time something happens, a tragedy happens, and then you have people come out, and now it feels like, oh, so you're coming out now? Where have you been? You know. When I hear Tavis Smiley criticizing Obama about saying he hasn't done anything for Black America, and when I hear somebody Dr. Dyson saying that Obama has given don't ask, don't tell, and they've received the right to get married everywhere. He's given the Hispanic brothers and sisters, they're getting the immigration reform worked on. The Jewish people are getting whatever it is that they're getting. But what are we getting? And my whole point was, every single one of those groups got together, formed a united bond, and that was it.
Okay, I agree with you, but here's the thing. So how many of them were stopped by programs like COINTELPRO? Are these other ethnic groups?
Well, that's the thing, though. That's the thing. It's politics. All right? It's politics. And the one thing I've always argued is Obama is more of a politician than an activist. He's not. I don't even consider him to be an activist. He's a politician. He plays the game of politics. And in politics, it's always whoever has the most support, whoever can generate the most funds and the most voices behind their cause will always be heard.
But see, you mentioned something that when I bring it up to people, they don't want to hear it. he got money from Goldman Sachs. So how much of an activist is he?
Yeah, I've never considered the man to be an activist. I don't consider him to be a civil rights leader because that's never been his motto. That's never been him.
No.
I mean, every time he even tried to dive into that pool, it always looked awkward because he's not used to it. That's never been him.
Okay, let's pause here though for a little clarity because you and I understand this. The majority of the people who are conscious within the African community, at least in North America, understand this. But when you speak to the Republicans that I call with almost on a daily basis, he's a left-wing, closeted Muslim who's got an anti-white agenda, who is funding secretly some black revolution some goddamn way, right? That he's pro-Arab and pro-Muslim, even though he's wiping as many out as possible. You think what I'm saying? They have it as that he was some sort of community activist, but you have the Australian journalist, John Pilger, who pointed out, amongst others, that there is nothing in his background that shows that he was a community activist at any time. The company that he used to work for, Business International, has a shady history. A shady history on working against the interests of indigenous people, against people of color, against people who are poor, and what have you. You know, what is the real Obama? Okay, so he attended Reverend Wright's church in Chicago. So what? You know, where is this reflected in his politics? And see, the thing about Reverend Wright is, Reverend Wright pretty much comes from the same political position that you do. You know, we need to empower ourselves. If capitalism is what it is, let's do it that way. He is an ex-Marine, Reverend Wright. I don't know how many people know this.
Yeah, and that's the fact that they willfully admitted to divulge to people out there. They just repeatedly kept pointing to the fact that this guy is a dissident, he's a terrorist, he's a domestic terrorist, and he's always spoken bad about America, and he's not to be trusted. And this is the type of people Obama associates himself with. That's the message they put out. Alright, nobody wanted to say, hey, this guy was actually a United States Marine. He served this country honorably.
Honorably. And he did something else, not to interrupt you, but he did something else I know a lot of people don't know about. President Lyndon Baines Johnson. You know, we talk about the Civil Rights Bill, we talk about when the Republicans crossed over, who the racist Democrats anyway, crossed over to the Republican Party, and the Republican Party, people who were halfway decent and, you know, were looking at America in terms of the Constitution and in terms of ideals, slid over to the Democrat Party. All right. He was on the surgical team that saved Lyndon Baines Johnson's life. He has a signed letter from Lady Bird Johnson thanking him for saving her husband's life. That's how anti-American Reverend Wright is.
Right. But you wouldn't hear about that.
You wouldn't hear about that. And one other thing, just because, you know, it's on my mind, because I wanted to say this as we were doing a warm up here. Leon Pinckney. Look up the name, brothers and sisters. Leon Pinckney. Brother Self-Made was bringing up World War I when we were, you know, talking earlier about, you know, things. And I wanted to point this out. He was the first person, the first man that was drafted for World War I. Leon Pinckney was a black man. The first American citizen inducted, drafted in the pool for World War I. And then you have Crispus Attucks. See, this is where Brother Self-Made is coming from. We've paid our goddamn dues here. But, you know, we've paid our dues here. So who is anybody in the United States to tell any African what they can and cannot do and whether or not we have a place in this system? See, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I just wanted people to understand this. I wanted our people to understand this. We've shed blood here just as much as any white man. And I want to speak up for the Indians, too. We had everything taken from us, but we've been on the battlefields in World War I, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, Grenada, Panama, and a whole bunch of other locations that I, you know, who is anybody to tell us that we don't have a legitimate place in the system? And this is why folks like me are upset with Obama. It's not a matter of because we disagree. I don't believe in that whole thing that we all need to be on the same page necessarily in terms of opinion. But where are you in support of those people who do what it is that, as self-made here, who articulates this in his personal life? He does everything that he's supposed to do. So it's like, why does he have to come around and then argue and have to think of a plan to become a part of the system? You know, self-made, your opinions on it. Your feelings on it.
It's devastating. It's devastating that, you know, after all these years, we're still fighting this war. It seems to be a perpetual war, you know, to survive. You know, to just to have the right to survive, to exist. You know, it's amazing that after all this struggle, after all these years, we still aren't considered to be fully citizens of this great nation. You know, our efforts are I'm looking for a light way to say it. You know, all the efforts we try to make are always looked down. You know, nobody wants to give us credit for it. Alright? Every time I get into arguments with people, just simple discussion. Yeah. They try to feed you this nonsense about, well, everything is fine. You guys have everything you wanted. All right. Well, you say we're equal. We've never been equal in this country. I mean, you go back all the way back to the creation of this nation. We were never equal to anyone here. All right. Even after we've done everything that needed to be done, even after we've shed blood just for a little recognition.
Hey, the first man to die in the American Revolution against the British was a black man.
Was a black man. Remember that.
A black Indian man. You know, if you really want to get down to brass tacks.
We've lived in a society that told us we couldn't eat at a restaurant just because we didn't look like the people that ate there too. You know what I'm saying? We live in a country where we couldn't go to a fucking park. Our kids couldn't go play in the park because it was for white people. But even after that, we still sit here and we see instances like what we saw in Florida not too long ago.
Uh-huh.
With the Trayvon Martin case. And they always find ways to try to equivocate on the story.
Well, hey, you know, they still say that Frederick Carter committed suicide.
Yeah, you guys kill each other every day, but you don't say anything about that. Oh, the hell we do. You just don't bring your cameras around to see it.
Mm-hmm.
All right? We do talk about it. All right? You don't see those people marching down in South Chicago, you know, saying that they don't want any more killing. All right? But it's so easy for people to just look at to point out to the flaws and be like, yeah, this is why you're not advancing. You know, you're not talking about a systematic governmental effort to keep us down from the beginning. All right, you don't talk about a black person not being able to get affordable housing just because they're black. All right.
Or medical care, for that matter.
Or Medicare. Or proper school. I mean, I watched a documentary that came out a couple of years ago, and it was unbelievable. It was unbelievable. I mean, you sit there and you watch this thing and you're amazed. This doesn't look like America. Mm-hmm. At all.
Well, you can go to any Indian reservation anywhere in North America or Canada for that matter and see that. third world, right in the middle of the richest, most powerful continent on the planet.
Absolutely. I mean, you have kids in the Bronx not able to go to a good school just because they live in a bad neighborhood.
Yeah, I mean, think of all the wasted human potential that's out there in the hood and on the reservations.
Right.
If they really gave a damn about trying to make this place strong, you know, you would empower your people. That's why I mentioned Hugo Chavez as an example. He empowered his people. When your people are strong, you're strong. But, you know, a lot of these conservatives and a lot of these, you know, hardcore bigots, they just don't see it that way. They want it all for themselves. You know, I mean, they look at the pyramids and don't see us connected to that, you dig?
Absolutely.
You know, they see us as being fools, and that's not true. And we accept a lot of this. So, you know, I mean, you know, a final, you know, inspirational, word, brother. You know, what do you have to say out there to the people of the fourth world and to the African community internationally, man? You know, what can we do, you know, psychologically, emotionally, spiritually to get above it?
I mean, I've always said the key to this thing is always to get together, because in unity we'll always supersede any obstacle that we face if we're united. All right, if you go back to the origination of every single civil rights movement, whether it was in Africa, here in America, or anywhere else, it only succeeded because people were united for, and they decided to fight towards a common goal. We have to find that. We have to find that united front and all be together for it. But if we're still divided, they'll always find a way to get between us. And that's always been the problem with us, because we're easily divided. All they have to do is just go behind the scenes and talk to some of the people, and then give them a little something, something behind the back. And next thing you know, they turn on their own people. And you have to wake up. You have to open your eyes and look around you. And things are moving. The world is moving at a faster pace than you can even imagine. And if you just sit there and do nothing, everything will pass you by. And all you have left is just nothing. Because these people, they have it all mapped out. If it was up to them, we wouldn't even be here at all. So we have to live here too. So why don't we make it count?
Well, as long as we can make it count with some sort of consciousness. You know, like I said, I'm not against us having anything. You know, I'm not against us having material things. You know, the question is, you know, where do the material things matter more than humanity? Where do the material things matter more than the survival or the existence or the sustainability of a people? You know, that's where I draw the line. You know, I'm not against anyone having anything.
Yeah, definitely. And I fully agree with you on that. I fully agree with you on that. We cannot allow a capitalistic system to continuously bring down the values of our people. All right, and threaten our survival in the long run. Because at this rate, we won't be around for much longer.
Yeah.
Because they're putting in place different ways to bring us down. All right, when you have a penitentiary system that's up on Wall Street making money off of people getting locked up, you have a problem, man.
Mm-hmm.
You have a serious problem when you have people betting that your kind will get locked up tomorrow morning, and we know that for sure, and we're putting our money on it.
Uh-huh. Yeah. You're betting against humanity when you do that.
Yeah. Seriously. Seriously. But every time you bring up these type of stories, like, I was watching a video from they did a little skit on what Bill O'Reilly said last week or earlier this week.
Yeah, with
on
Donald
the show.
Yeah.
And he was talking about how Obama and how black people can better themselves. And I sat there and I rose. And this is the sentiment that most of these folks, they feel, this is how they feel. This is how they feel. They just sit there and say, why don't you give your own people better opportunities? Why don't you? But if you already blocking everything, how do we even get up? I mean, if you always, you have your hand on our head and you pushing us down, how do we get up?
Exactly.
It's amazing. This clown is get up there and start talking about it. They're all on board with him. They're jumping up. That's exactly what we're talking about. These guys are amazing bastards. They don't want to do anything. Okay. All right.
Well, you know, I mean, it's not a racial thing so much as I think it is a class thing and a issue of understanding. You know, a lot of people, once they think that there's a gravy train out there, they will work to get on the gravy train rather than do for themselves. And, you know, a lot of that is learned helplessness. You know, because I've never understood the, you know, personally, you know, when people want to come to me, you know, not just conservatives, a lot of folks, we all get caught up in these memes and they say, oh yeah, well, you know, a lot of people like to be homeless or, you know, these guys don't want a job. And I don't believe that. You know, I've always believed that, you know, a man wants to sit at the head of his table and know that he can take care of business, to know that he can provide for his family. You know, I mean, what do you have to say as a real final word about the mythology of the lazy African Negro in America, you know, that doesn't want anything but a handout?
that's always been funny to me, man. That's, you know, that idea, and it's not something that's nascent. You know, it's not something that's new. You know, going back to all the way back to Thomas Jefferson, when our founding fathers, you know, as they usually said,
yeah, the irremovable veil of blackness,
yeah. he questioned the African, the Negro's ability to think for himself. He was the paradigm of a white supremacist.
Mm-hmm.
Because he strongly believed that black people were inherently inferior to whites. But at the same time, when he went home at night, guess what he was doing?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. but these people are not able to do anything.
No, he had to go to France. Remember, the French had to say to him, they say, isn't this man your son? And he says, yes. Yeah. But you treat him as your slave, because he is my slave, but he's your son.
Yeah.
how do you gel that with your science?
Right.
And he had to write a whole book about it, Notes on the State of Virginia.
On the State of Virginia, Notes of Virginia. Because remember when he wrote, because he was tasked with the task of writing most of the Declaration of Independence. When that first line of faith, it's self-evident that all men are created equal. To this day, they haven't been able to fully agree on what that actually meant, because at the time, they felt like he couldn't have meant that everybody here was equal, because obviously we have these people that are under us, and they're not even considered people.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So, are you saying that they too are equal to us? Is that what we're doing here? So I can already imagine them, you know, sitting around, and for years, even scholars, they couldn't agree on what actually he meant by that, because for years they even alluded to the fact that, hey, maybe he was talking about, you know, all white men in America were equal to white people in England, because the king was, you know, thought he was above white in America, you know, and they flipped it whichever way they felt like it, and eventually it got to the point where it is right now. But I'm gonna live with this. we are a strong people. We are a beautiful people. We are a committed people. We have this inexorable faith in us that pushes us to go far beyond what our abilities are. And because of that, we've been able to sustain all the oppression that was brought upon us for years. We've always been able to rise up. And that belief in itself will never leave us. And that's where we draw our core strength. Right? And no matter how many years they try to keep us down, they will never succeed because we've always been able to come back up. And we just have to keep on believing in that.
Well, right. I'm okay with believing, but I want to have a plan too.
Oh definitely. That's why I talked about being united. Being united is having a thoughtful plan that we can put together and actually find our way out of this thing. When I talk to other young people. I always try to break it down to them that remember how everything else came into being. You know, people had to get together and think in the same direction for them to be successful. You can't just be satisfied. You can't be content with just your personal gain, your personal wealth. You have to be able to expand that so other people can benefit from it.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
And I think we also need to remember that a lot of people got hurt, and some were beat, and some were hung, and some were burned, and some were shot, just so that, you know, we could be here.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Absolutely.
And, you know, I think a lot of young people, you know, they don't know that history because people don't want to tell them, you know.
They don't want to tell them that, though. They don't want them to know that part of the story. I mean, it's a beautiful thing, man. Because I didn't really get involved into a lot of, until I was like past 20 years old, you know. I was just out of curiosity, you know. And it's always been on my mind. So every time I get to talk to a lot of young people. Yeah, I was in Cameroon back in 2008, and it was in the middle of a small. It almost broke out into a civil war because, you know, people came down on in the streets because there'd been so much tension and anger trapped inside of people that all it took was just a few students getting beaten for all of that just turned into a catastrophe, and in a matter of days it spread out. It spread out, and next thing you know, we almost had a civil war. And when I sat down and talked to people, what I wanted them to understand was that you have the power, you have the ability to change things if you really can get together, you can change things. And when we look at what's happening in Libya, when we look at what's happening in Egypt, and what's happening in Tunisia, I mean, you think about what happened in Tunisia, because this is where the recent movement, political movement that we've seen over the past 3 or 4 years, they all started out in Tunisia. And it was all over a man, a peasant, who was beaten by the police, and his little stand was trashed and destroyed, and he went to complain to the police, and they arrested him. When they finally released him, he burned himself up in front of the station.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't mean to cut you off, but I want people to understand that self-immolation is happening in India on a daily basis. The farmers who have been put out by Monsanto seed are burning themselves to death, sometimes in protest and sometimes out of pure desperation because they can't feed their families.
They can't do anything else.
Yeah, we're having it. It's happening in Tibet as well. You know, self-immolation has become the new form of protest. So continue, self-made. I just wanted people to understand that it's not limited to the example that you're mentioning.
And this is what started the uprising that we're seeing in the Arabic Peninsula. From that single person, that single individual, immolating himself in front of people, it brought about change. The president Ben Ali, he just left the country, and right after that movement, kind of found some type of a middle ground, and they had a different political system in place. It moved on to Egypt, and Mubarak was kicked out. And once it left Egypt, it went on to Libya. Mm-hmm. And before you knew it, it spread out to Syria. So all that that should tell you is, it's still about the people, because people still have the power. The power remains in the hands of the people. So if you really confide within yourself to get together with your brothers and sisters, you can make you can change things. It's possible. It's not a utopic endeavor. It actually can happen. You can get up. Get together with some friends and start talking about what we can do to change situations. And before you know it, you have a crowd behind you. Mm-hmm. All right, I've read the stories of the United Defense League and how the bus boycott of the South, it came about and brought about change that led to the civil rights movement as we know it. But well, if those people, if they hadn't started in churches, talking, you know, in a home,
the deacons for defense,
we would never be here ever. But they stood together. I mean, they stood up against a system that repeatedly offended them, that repeatedly berated them, but they never gave up. Because they felt like even if we fail, the next generation will live to see better days. And that's something that we need to cultivate again. And because it's been lost for so long, and we're having a hard time finding this type of mindset, you know, in this particular generation. You know, people are no longer willing to sacrifice. They're not willing to sit down, and then, you know, even marches, people are not marching as much as they did. You know, they're not even marching with conviction. Mm-hmm. Right? People just get up and get out and say, okay, I march too. You know, I think that's, that's what we need to take away from this, man. We definitely need to be more determined and have a plan, man. We have to have a plan. That's one of the most important things that I kept saying. And every time I get on these issues, especially when it comes down to politicians and what the president has or hasn't done for us. I keep saying, I mean, we have to have a plan. You know, we have to have a plan because everybody else is coming up with a plan, and then they're getting support behind it. And then, you know, next thing you know, they're getting something done. And if you just sit there, you know, and if you have the plan but not the support, you're not going to get the result. If you got the support and not the plan, then it's still not going to get anything done. You have to have both of those qualities. You have to have those both of them on the table before you can actually sit down and say, okay, I'm ready to talk. I want to talk. You know, if they don't want to listen, you're going to hear us. You're going to listen to us one way or another. We have a plan and we know what we need. We know what you have to give us, and we demand it. Alright? So, yeah.
Okay. Alright, you've been listening to the thoughts of Selfmade_G22. You can find him on Twitter where he's giving his views on what's happening with the diaspora and how people can make an uplift, you know, make a come up, but do so consciously without hurting anybody else. That's always the best way. Okay, and you can also check out his site at dreamcatcher.com. You can see what he's doing. And, you know, that's about it, man. You know, I'm self-made, man. You know, thanks for coming on, man, and expressing your thoughts.
No doubt, man. No doubt. It was great having you there, man. I truly appreciate that, you know.
You know, it's always good to speak to a brother who's out here doing something on the local, personal level, you know, within his circle,
sir.
Because that's the way things work, you know, people
that's
talk to each
it.
Other.
Absolutely.
You know, the as the Europeans would put it, within their way of looking at things, the salon idea of making progressive change.
True.
All right. So, you know, this is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. This is the Angry Indian. You've been listening to a talk between myself and self-made_G22. You can find his work at dreamcatcher.com. This is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Please stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid from The Horn, headonradionetwork.com, and you're listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
To respond to a particular new language, psycho and physical instruction of containment had to be created for both. You see, it goes this way. A wild horse, this is how the white man had this thing, and this is the late great Frederick Douglass put this together. A wild horse, or a wild or natural African, in the mind of the slaveholder was dangerous. Even if they were captured, they were dangerous. For why was that? Because they still had the tendency to seek their customary freedom. And in the process of seeking their freedom, a horse in its natural state or an African in its natural state would kill that slaveholder. So therefore, to ensure their safety, both had to be broken. They felt that we can't rest. We dare not sleep. Because they sleep while you awake, and while you awake, they are asleep. So these Africans are dangerous near the family house. And it's too much labor to watch them away from the house, and you can't get them to work in their natural state because they want to be free. That's natural, y'all, to want to be free. Something's really wrong when you've got an African who does not want to be free. And yet I see so many of ours today who don't want to be free because they're comfortable on the plantation. They don't want to be free. So, how does this breaking take place? The whole purpose of breaking the African was for the sake of taking the body. And messing up the mind. Did y'all hear that? Break the will to resist. Break it. Now the breaking process, again, according to the slaveholder, was the same for the African as it was for the horse. Same process. In other words, this thing is so deep how they go. It actually says, you must keep your eye and thoughts on the female. Sisters, you've got to understand how important your role is. Their agenda was keep your eye on the black female and on the offspring of the horse and the female. Pay little attention to the generation of the original breaking. In other words, those first few people that you broke, don't pay them no mind. mind. Your goal is on future generations. Therefore, if you break the female mother, this is Willie Lynch's concept, she will break the offspring in its early years of development. Did y'all hear that? If you break the female mother, she will break her own offspring in the early years of its development until it's old enough to work. And when it is old enough to work, she will deliver her own offspring up to the slaveholder. Because her normal female protective tendencies will have been lost in the original breaking process. It goes on to say, for example, take the wild stud horse, a female horse, and an already infant horse, and compare the process with two captured African males in their natural state. Now check this out. This is going to make you a little angry. Two African males in their natural state, a pregnant African woman with her infant offspring. It goes on to say, breed the mare and the stud until you have a desired offspring. Then you can turn the stud to freedom until you need him again. Train the female horse where she will eat out of your hand. And she in turn will train her infant horse to eat out of your hand also. When it comes to breaking the uncivilized African, use the same process, but vary the degree and step up the pressure so as to do a complete reversal of mind. Check this, what they did. Take the meanest and most restless African. Y'all see this in your head now. Take the meanest and most restless African, strip him of his clothes in front of the remaining male Africans. And the females and the African infants. Tar and feather him. Tie each leg to a different horse faced in opposite directions. Set him afire and beat both horses to pull him apart in front of the other Africans while they're looking at him. The next step is to take a bull whip and beat the remaining African males to the point of death in front of the females. Y'all hear this? Don't kill them though. But put the fear of God in them. Now, I wonder what God is talking about. For don't kill them, because they can be. It says here they can be useful for future breeding. The breaking process of the African woman. Take the African female. Check this out now, and run a series of tests on her to see if she will submit to your desires. White man, test her in every way because she is the most important factor for good economics. All right. Y'all hear this? The black female is the most important factor for good economics. If she shows any sign of resistance in submitting completely to your will, do not hesitate to use the bull whip on her to extract the last bit of resistance out of her. Take care not to kill her, for in doing so, you spoil good economics. When she is in complete submission, she will train her own offspring in their early years to submit to you when they become of age. Understanding is the best thing. Therefore, we shall go deeper into this area of the subject matter concerning what we have produced here in this breaking process of the African female. It gets deep here, y'all, because it says, at this point, we have now reversed the relationship. Now, see what has happened. They have taken the strong black African male and totally utterly destroyed his image while the women and children were watching. So now in the back of the woman's mind, black man, you can't protect us. Y'all follow this thing? You are not in the position to look after us. That's what's happening here. So in her, see, here goes, I'm saying, in her natural state, she would have a strong dependency on that African man. I better say that again, since we are so unnaturalized now. In her natural state, the black woman would have a strong dependency on that black African man. Whew, man. And it goes on to say, and she would raise her offspring to be dependent like she is. So in the natural state of the African, the woman and the child was very dependent on the strong African man. Do y'all see what I'm saying?
Yes.
It goes on to say, nature provided for this type of balance. And then it goes on to notice what he says. He says, but we reversed nature. I need to go for a walk.
You are listening to the Young, Grindian, and Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. We'll talk for the fourth world.